food, glorious food. We dream, we eat, we fantasize about food. Join me, Corinne Fregoni, in a conversation with Julia Moskin about her career as a New York Times food staff reporter, her recent Pulitzer Prize, and some of the controversies her writings have generated. Coming up next on Through the Eyes of Women. On a lark, I contacted Julia Moskin for this interview after I found out we graduated from the same high school in New York City. That connection prompted her to graciously share her thoughts and experiences writing for the New York Times as a food critic. Can writing about food be so entertaining, intellectually stimulating, and occasionally generate so much controversy? I highly recommend that you read some of her columns to appreciate her clear, expressive, and humorous insights into the world of food. She also has some excellent recipes. Welcome, Julia, to our show.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with how your career in food writing unfolded and how you ended up working for the New York Times.
You know, food writing, I think now, is something that a lot of people take for granted. There are so many blogs and so many magazines, but it really was not much of a job when I was growing up, at least. It certainly wasn't something that you could set out to want to be. I did eat a lot when I was young. My parents were great food lovers, and actually they named me after Julia Child. That is how interested in food they were. And they took us out to eat a lot when I was young. I don't have any professional culinary experience, but I was always a big reader, and I certainly recommend that for anyone who is interested in food writing or becoming a food writer. That's a question that I get a lot. I read writers like M.F.K. Fisher, A.J. Liebling, Joseph Wexberg, Elizabeth David. From a young age, I actually worked at a cookbook store in New York City in high school.
Of course, only in New York City. Here we have a shelf of cookbooks in our independent bookstore, but not a whole store.
Well, that cookbook store, Kitchen Arts and Letters, I recently wrote a profile of it in the New York Times. And because of the knowledge that I had, really more than any particular experience, it helped me to get a job as an assistant editor of cookbooks when I was right out of college. Editing cookbooks and classics and pretty much anything I was interested in was a great experience, but I never really liked office work. And so what I did in my spare time was that I started writing restaurant reviews for like one of the just giveaway papers that used to exist. Now there's, of course, not very many of them, but the New York Press in the 1990s was a really hip paper, and you could pretty much write for them based on not much experience. What I was doing at work at that time was reviewing cookbook proposals, and then what I was doing on this side job was restaurant reviews. And after a while, I was able to sort of combine the two, where I was ghostwriting cookbooks for restaurant chefs. And that was my transition to becoming a food writer. So it really certainly was an accident. And I never really imagined that there would be a job that combined sort of a hobby that I had of food and cooking. And also the interest in cultural history that I had cultivated in college. My concentration was history and literature, and learning about the daily lives of people, and of course, especially women, and the history of cooking was something that I had always been really interested in. So that is something that I studied, and being able to do research and to examine the significance of food, even though, of course, it's a newspaper, I always have to, you know, write about what's new and what's fresh and what's hot. Really, my heart is in the past and, you know, where all of these things come from. Why do we cook what we cook? Why do we eat what we eat?
Can you answer some of those questions?
Well, I think the answer is always changing. There are so many factors now that come from outside the home. You know, there certainly was a time when it was unfathomable that a girl would reach the age of 12 and not be able to cook for her family every meal, if possible, since, you know, a girl of 12 was considered pretty much adult enough to master all of those skills. Now, of course, that's not the case. And, you know, the combination of microwave ovens and Instagram and snack giants, and, you know, there's a constant drumbeat of, like, you know, American cooking is dead, American mealtimes are over, millennials only want to eat snacks. And yet, in every generation, there also persistently is a group of people who, I think, experience food more as I do, which is that it's part of culture. It's a choice. You don't have to be interested in food, and you can eat sweet green, or you can eat Hot Pockets for the rest of your life if you feel like it. But if you're interested in it, it can be a really great source of intrigue and change and examination. Of course, the fact is that everyone has to eat, and that is something that makes writing about food really gratifying, because there are a lot of people who have no interest in fashion or no interest in classical music, or but it's really not possible to just have no interest in food. And people are almost always happy to talk to me, which I know is not the case with many people in journalism.
What you've said has generated a lot of questions for me. You mentioned that you started out as a hobby, and now it's a profession. How has that transition been for you?
It's difficult sometimes. I certainly don't cook as much as I used to, partly because I now have a very demanding job, and I have two kids. And if I were to be perfectly honest, I would have to admit that my husband does most of the day-to-day cooking in our household.
But is he good?
In some ways, yes, he's a pretty good cook. He's gotten a lot better in the last few years as I have been working more and cooking less. And it is, you know, proof that really the way to learn to cook is just to do it. You know, there are certain things about cooking that are physical, and there's only so much you can learn from a cookbook, and some cookbooks are better than others, certainly. And you also have to learn which recipes you can trust and which ones you can't. So in some ways, it is a learn-by-doing situation, obviously. You know, I learned the basics when I was pretty young because my parents were always cooking. And, you know, if you're around it, it just happens.
Do you think women's approach to cooking is different from men's approach?
Not really. Look, it's someone said this to me recently, Virginia Willis, a wonderful Southern food writer. She said, everything is women's work until someone's getting paid for it. And, you know, it is certainly the case that now that cooking is more glamorous and in some cases more financially rewarding, now that there is more of a celebrity chef culture, you know, men are probably more interested in cooking. But I don't really believe in that there's anything gendered really about cooking, except that it traditionally was a chore and therefore women had to do it. And there are so many ways in which it's not a chore anymore, and it can be so much more of a choice. And that is sort of my goal, is to always help people make that choice to cook, because it's so easy not to. It's so easy just to heat something up, or just to buy something on the way home, or just have cereal for dinner, which is, you know, what I used to do quite often when I was only feeding myself. So it is a choice. And I think for men or women, it's just a question of finding what you're interested in. It doesn't have to be about fire and meat, or, you know, blenders and smoothies.
Well, you mentioned that it's become more glamorous. And I'm wondering, for those of us lucky enough not only to have enough food to eat, but also to be able to afford healthy and delicious cuisine, what has contributed to this current wild enthusiasm and obsession with fancy food? And I wonder if it's an escape from the complexity of the world we live in, or does it reflect the complexity of the world with the complicated food recipes and presentations that you can come across in restaurant reviews or chef biographies or whatever?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think for those of us who kind of have to eat that way all the time, it is a strange and slightly mystifying thing, because it doesn't seem like, you know, it's not the kind of thing that I crave. You know, when I go and I have like a tasting menu of all these, like, you know, perfect little bites with weird garnishes and crumbles on the side and, you know, dots of this and that, like, I don't find that to be the most satisfying way to eat. And often I have cereal when I come home after that kind of meal.
I was wondering what your comfort food is.
But it is very entertaining. You know, this is the way in which food has become something that is people sometimes say, you know, instead of going out for dinner and a movie, now dinner is the movie. Dinner is the entertainment and the element of being surprised, the element of being mystified, you know, which you wouldn't really think would be a value of food, where, you know, you order something and it comes out and you really have no idea which part of it is the thing that you ordered, right? Like you order a seafood sausage appetizer and something comes out with like peaks and valleys and hills and, you know, on the plate, you just don't even know where to begin. But I think if you can relax into it and not feel like I'm supposed to know what this is and let your server guide you, I think a lot of people have resistance to being told what to do by waiters. That's a, you know, traditional kind of like, nope, I'm fine. No, I don't have any questions. But you can get so much better service and really enjoy your meals so much. You have to enter into the spirit of it being both entertainment and education. And if you're in a place that does that well, you'll feel like you're in good hands and like you're having a good meal.
Well, you're in New York and I'm in California. Would you describe regional differences in the cuisines of the two coasts?
Well, New York and California have traditionally had an opposition, right, in which New York was traditional, Eurocentric, expensive, you know, caviar and foie gras, and a lot of fanciness. And then there was this idea of, in California, simplicity, of back to the land, of nature, of, as David Chang once referred to the food as Japanese figs on a plate. And he has said, that's not cooking, that's shopping. And, you know, both of those things are actually highly valued now. I don't think people see them in opposition the way that they used to. And, of course, there's room for every style. And, in fact, a lot of the most innovative, creative cuisine that is happening now is happening in the Bay Area at places like Manresa and Qua and Quince. So it's not as simple as it used to be. Now a lot of the restaurants on the West Coast do very, you know, complicated food. I think Julia Child once said that, you know, that when she looked at a plate of restaurant food, the prettier it looked, the less she wanted to eat it, because she could see how someone's fingers had been all over it. And that's not really the case, and certainly literally not fingers. Now chefs use tweezers and all sorts of, you know, quasi-medical instruments. The plating is so beautiful. And I do think that in California, there is more of an appreciation for these like naturalistic foodscapes, if you could call them. The chef Dominique Kren, a French woman in San Francisco, does that really beautifully. And that in New York, there is still a little bit of, you know, stand up and pay attention to me, like the famous architectural desserts of the 90s, things being stacked up and brightly colored and meant to be, you know, distracting and glamorous.
Well, you keep generating more questions for me, but I'm going to take a break right now. You're tuned into Through the Eyes of Women, and I'm Corinne Fregoni, and you're listening to Julia Moskin, New York Times food staff reporter, and we're getting into the whole food culture of this country. You've brought up a couple of things. You mentioned foie gras. I was wondering, do you find it difficult to reconcile food connoisseur tastes with healthy food choices and with ethical food choices?
That is a huge issue. First, I'll tell you what sort of the Times thinks about that, and not me personally. You know, we have extensive coverage of many aspects of food, of the business of food, of the science of food, of the health aspects of food. None of that is in the New York Times food section. We are about pleasure, when we are about deliciousness. We're about helping people become better cooks. So, and that does include cooking food that you feel good about. But there's a lot of separateness when we're talking about the choices. Personally, one of the things that I have really come around to is buying grass-fed and farm-raised meat, which is, as everyone who has tried to do this knows, anywhere from 4 times as expensive to 10 times as expensive supermarket meat, or even meat at a nice butcher. It really is a fact that in America, historically, food prices have been artificially low. Our food costs are much lower than any country in Europe. People simply expect things to cost a certain amount of money, and that's what they're used to. But once you kind of take that and rethink it, you know, where are my priorities? What, you know, do I want to have a more expensive lamb chop, or do I want to have a more expensive phone? You know, you can make those kinds of choices and thereby ensure at least that the meat you buy is responsibly raised and sourced. I'm not really going to get into vegetarian and vegan lifestyle choices. Obviously, those are great for the planet as well as for individuals. But there are ways to eat more responsibly than you're currently eating, no matter what level you're at. And so that's what we try to encourage.
Would you say food is a political issue?
You would certainly think so, reading the comments on my articles. It is, of course, a huge part of daily life. I just wrote an article about Southern cooking where I had two Southern cooks sort of explore what really the difference is between Southern food and soul food. And that brings up all sorts of questions about race, tradition, class, wealth, ownership, accountability. And, you know, in that way, food can be very political just because it is so entwined with people's lives.
I did not get to read that article, but I'd love it if you could give me a synopsis.
Well, it was a question of, what is the difference between soul food and Southern food? Is soul food a subset of Southern food? Is it in opposition to Southern food? And why do those terms even exist? Because in the South, actually, they're quite meaningless. And it turns out that even though we think of soul food pretty much as African-American food, it's actually a very specific kind of African-American food, food that was eaten in the North and that came to be called soul food by people who wanted to market their food, mostly to white people. And the word soul, like soul patch and soul brother, was getting thrown around a lot in the 60s and kind of affixed itself to food. So soul food has a particular name, but these two people, who both had really deep Southern roots, agreed that there really aren't dishes in the South that black people eat this and white people eat that. It's really much more just a question of who's making the food and who is naming it in a way. It's especially hard to disentangle because so much of what we consider Southern food, even if the Southern chefs that we've mostly seen on TV or in magazines are white, the fact is that Southern food was almost always executed by African Americans, whether it was for families that they worked for, families that they were enslaved by, or their own families. So there really was a lot more cooking done by black women in the South than any other group, probably for the first 300 years of American history.
And I always was under the impression that soul food used ingredients that were less expensive, more available as leftovers for people who didn't have a whole lot of money to cook.
Well, you know, now there's a really, I wouldn't call it an industry exactly, but a whole body of academic work that is rising up around the African-American food tradition, whether we're talking about the cooks in the White House or cooks on plantations. And soul food is something that has been extensively studied and something that many historians now believe is that soul food is actually more expensive because it tends to be the food of celebration. It's the food sort of like Italian-American food is richer and meatier and more extravagant than Italian food in Italy. Soul food, when we're talking about fried chicken, we're talking about mac and cheese. I mean, those were luxury foods in the South, and you would have them for a special occasion. So even though, yes, there's also chitlins and neck bones, the fact is that everybody ate those. Everybody who was poor ate them. And it certainly, that was not in any way a black-white thing. Even though people think of soul food as specifically the food that black people ate, it's really much more complicated than that.
Very interesting. Well, before we run out of time, and we still have a little, I want to talk about your Pulitzer Prize for public service that you won along with Kim Severson for investigative reporting of sexual harassment in certain New York restaurant. Tell us a little about it and tell us what the consequences are of your reporting.
Well, the consequences are ongoing, which is a good thing. After the Harvey Weinstein story started to come out in October of 2017, I think every journalist at the Times and probably every journalist in America felt like it's time to look around and see, well, who's the Harvey Weinstein of my beat, which is to say, who is the person who's an open secret, you know, that everyone in this industry knows about, but no one ever talks about. And in our case, there were a couple of candidates. The restaurant business is not known for its professionalism and refinement. Certainly, restaurant kitchens are historically spaces where women are just treated appallingly, and that is really only just beginning to change. So what we focused on were cases where it wasn't just that a man happened to be, you could call it handsy or playful or all of these terms that have historically been used as code for sexual assault or something short of sexual assault. What we ended up hearing the most of was cases where women were being systematically mistreated by men, not at a Harvey Weinstein level, not bathrobes and potted plants, but we focus on the people who we received the most tips about. And it turned out that at the Spotted Pig, a restaurant in the West Village in New York that is known for kind of being wild and fun and playful, it turns out that, one of the reasons that it has that reputation is that the owner, Ken Friedman, is someone who was friends with a lot of celebrities and also tended to not be entirely sober at work and was very touchy, handsy with the waitresses. There are no charges of sexual assault associated with the story that we wrote. It was really a workplace issue, a systematic touching, kissing, squeezing, to the extent that it was not really possible for women who worked for him, which is to say in the dining rooms, not in the kitchen, to say no. And, that in and of itself spread out over 20 years and dozens of women who we spoke to was enough to, bring that empire crashing down. He worked with April Bloomfield, a very famous female chef who has been very clear that the kitchen was her responsibility and the dining room was his responsibility. Now, there's a lot of dispute about that, and she hasn't really spoken publicly. But since then, the seven restaurants that they owned together, some of them have closed, and the others have been carved up between the two of them. Someone who is an investor in the Spotted Pig and a regular at the Spotted Pig is the chef Mario Batali, who Eater did a very big and excellent reporting job on the number of women that he has approached, assaulted, not usually women who work for him. And that's often has been the case in this industry, is that there are a lot of men who are not as feminist and self-possessed as we would wish, especially late at night. It is a late night industry. There's a lot of drinking. There's a lot of heat. There's a lot of tension. And, some people love that about the restaurant industry. But obviously, it should be a choice. It shouldn't be mandatory. And since then, Mario Batali's whole empire has also come crashing down because, in fact, he is facing charges of sexual assault. And he's being investigated by the New York City Police Department for some incidents that took place at the Spotted Pig, which became so notorious for partying and bad behavior that it had a room that the staffers called the rape room. Not very seriously. It was a bit of black humor to them, but it certainly reflected the kind of behavior that went on there and that obviously was, known and sanctioned by the owner. And so I'm really proud of that work. Now, that said, no one becomes a food writer because we think we're going to receive lots of serious journalism awards. Usually working on the food section is not considered as prestigious as working on the news section. There's still a distinction in newsrooms between the news, what the men do, and then what used to be called the ladies' pages, which used to come out on Wednesdays in every newspaper, and that was the three F's, food, fashion, and furnishings. And those of us who write about that stuff still, to a certain extent, feel like our work is not respected. And so to get a Pulitzer Prize, to be put in the same category as the reporters who brought down Bill O'Reilly and Harvey Weinstein and Matt Lauer was really, really exciting for us. It felt like something that we were winning for the food writers of America.
And showing that food is more than just food.
Yeah.
Well, we have to wrap up, unfortunately, but I have another question. What advice do you give to your children about food?
What I've done with my kids is pretty similar to what was done with me, which is that, I don't force them to learn to cook, but I keep them in the kitchen. Our kitchen is open to pretty much all the rest of our house. And so to see me cooking, to see their dad cooking, they obviously understand that it's something that we care about. It's something that they see us spending time on. We don't have a lot of rules. and it's not certainly not a, you know, everyone has to clean their plate situation. You don't have to eat everything, but you do have to taste everything. That's our main advice. A lot of kids, you know, they don't like the way something looks and they won't taste it, or they don't like the way it smells and they won't taste it. And that I won't stand for. You have to taste it. You don't know what it's like until you put it in your mouth. After that, it's up to you. You know, when I was young, I thought I would grow up and I would, you know, fill my house with Fruit Loops and Doritos and all of the things that I wanted that my parents didn't have in the house because they were hippies and we definitely did not have sugar cereals and packet snacks. And of course, that's not how I want to eat now.
And what do you see yourself doing in the next 10 to 20 years?
Oh my goodness. Well, people always say to me, aren't you tired of writing about food? Don't you get bored? And for me, it touches on so many subjects. I mean, I do write recipes and work on that. But, you know, there is so much reporting on food that has to do with immigrant communities and assimilation and women's work, all kinds of things that I feel like are really at the heart of life. And it's really such a good language. The language of food is something that is understandable to everyone in a way. And cooking, of course, is also one of the skills that women can really be valued for, and in many cultures really are valued for. It's not the same everywhere as it is in the United States, where cooking was, especially after convenience foods and dishwashers and stuff came in, you know, the idea that you would just get your cooking and your eating over with as fast as possible, that was the message for a long time. And now the pendulum has kind of swung the other way. And so, you know, thinking about food, considering it, and fortunately writing about it is something that I don't think I'll ever get tired of.
That's wonderful, because I enjoy reading your articles. Tell me what your current projects are.
Right now I am working on a history of ranch dressing, which, you know, part of the challenge of being a food writer is to find what's interesting and unique and special about something that everyone takes for granted. And, you know, it turns out that there is a Hidden Valley Ranch. It's not a working ranch anymore, but there was. So that's the kind of history that I enjoy digging into and conveying to readers. And, of course, the fall preview, there is, you know, sort of an annual burst of restaurants that open in New York after Labor Day. That's certainly where the big investors, they want to have splashy openings. And then there's always Thanksgiving, which is our Olympics, our Academy Awards, definitely the big event of the year at the food section. So we're always thinking about it.
It'll keep you busy, not just for a few months, but for a few years. I recently read an article of yours called Why Work When You Can Procrastinate. And that really hit home for me. What made you decide to write about this syndrome?
Well, this is an example of a kind of reporting that we do more and more, which I really love. This is essentially a story that came from Instagram, where procrastibaking is a hashtag. And it's something, of course, I'll explain it for most people feel like, oh, yes, I know exactly what you mean. So procrastibaking is when you bake in order to avoid doing something else, usually some kind of quote unquote real work. Baking is apparently uniquely suited to this because you sort of feel like you're being productive. You can, you know, justify that you're baking, you're making some bread, you're making some muffins, you're, you know, actually getting something done. But in fact, you know, what you really should be doing is working on your taxes. So someone invented it as a hashtag. It's certainly not a term that I came up with, but it is one of those things that so many people related to. And I started seeing the hashtag pop up so much on the bakers that I follow. Instagram is a really fun venue for food. It's just perfect for that. You know, we'll use Instagram in all kinds of ways, but being able to see, you know, really what professional bakers are doing every day and how they're developing new desserts, new ideas. That's just one example. You know, chefs and food in Tokyo and food in the Philippines and food in Africa. There's so much to see out there that there really was never a way to do that before. And it's also a way for people to connect with things like procrastibaking, where it turns out there are lots and lots of people who do that.
Well, thank you so much for helping us explore the food culture of this country and also of the world. It's very fascinating, and I appreciate that you shared your time with us. Thank you, Julia.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Through the Eyes of Women, I'm your host, Corinne Fragoni. My guest today was Julia Moskin, New York Times food staff reporter, and we've been talking about the food culture and the history of food in this country. Through the Eyes of Women is a collaborative team effort produced for KHSU located at Humboldt State University. Thanks to today's engineer and editor, Jesse Eden. You can listen to this show again or to post listener comments, visit our blog at khsuwomen.com. Join us again next Monday at 1:30 right here on KHSU.